Good morning and thank you very much for joining us. Delighted to welcome Dr. Leonie Hoops to New Zealand and also to Hospice New Zealand.
Thank you for having me.
We're really very pleased that you're here with us today. You will have seen that Leonie comes to New Zealand with a real lived experience of providing palliative care in a health system where euthanasia is legal and practiced regularly. So I'm just asking if people can mute their phones, please. We've got quite a lot of noise happening here. We can hear people talking. It's quite distracting. Sorry about this, but I just need you to create a nice quiet space. So Leonie is the head of the Division of Palliative Medicine, and she's the Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine, Queen's University. She holds the W. Ford Conwell Chair in Palliative Medicine. Leonie co-founded the new Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada subspecialty program in palliative medicine that opened in 2017 and is the vice chair of the Royal College Specialty Committee in Palliative Medicine. Leonie, it's a real pleasure to welcome you here today and we really look forward to listening to your talk, Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide in Canada, a Cautionary Tale.
Thank you for having me and thank you for all the people that are joining remotely. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to share my, as you said, my lived experiences as being a palliative care physician in Canada in the new era of euthanasia in Canada, almost 3 years. I believe you all have copies of my slides. I put a lot of information in there because I want you to have it for background, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on some of the sections because I think we want to allow as much time as possible for questions and conversation together. So hopefully I'll just let you know when we're kind of going to quickly go through some of the preamble around the Canadian context. But that's there for your reference then if you have further questions, and I can also be reached by email if you have questions about it. So we'll move on to the objectives. So I'm going to start with a brief overview of euthanasia and assisted suicide, which in Canada is called medical assistance in dying, MAID. And I'm going to review with you some of the difficulties that we live on a day-to-day basis since euthanasia has been legalized, including changing criteria for eligibility for euthanasia, the difficulty with conscience protection for objecting physicians, and the rights of institutions, including hospices and palliative care units, to be able to opt out of providing it at their site, the idea of slippery slope, lack of safeguards for vulnerable people. I'll briefly mention some of our issues with oversight and monitoring, but I think less relevant for today to allow more questions. So, and then really the impact on practicing in palliative care. So hopefully that will meet your needs. So move on to the next slide. What is euthanasia and assisted suicide? And I know many of you are familiar with this. You have shared a brochure that has been created by Hospice New Zealand, which is great. But just to be clear, so we're all on the same page and using the same language for this presentation, euthanasia and assisted suicide refers to death intentionally caused by administration of a lethal dose of a drug prescribed by a physician. When the patient takes an oral medication themselves, that's called physician-assisted suicide. And when the doctor directly administers the lethal dose of drugs, usually via an intravenous, that's what we call euthanasia in Canada. And almost all the cases in Canada are euthanasia. In 2017, there was one out of 2,700 cases. So, and that's consistent with other countries when given the option, euthanasia is the preferred choice for suicide. Next slide. So in Canada, I've said this already, we're talking about a term called medical aid in dying, which we in the palliative care community really worked and fought long and hard prior to the legislation being enacted to not have that term because it's misleading. It is what we do every day in palliative care. We provide support for patients who are dying, and we provide medical aid to help them die well. But we do not in our intention to cause death. And so it's created a lot of confusion in the Canadian public as well as in the Canadian health system and medical providers. And when this was first all came to be in 2016 with the legislation, in fact, the physicians in Canada and other healthcare providers expected this to be part of palliative care. And it took us a long time and a lot of intense advocacy and ongoing advocacy for this not to become part of what we do in palliative care, because there, and I'm sure you all live this every day, and especially as we approach the tabling of the legislation back to Parliament here in New Zealand, there's just such a misunderstanding of the medications we use in palliative care, and a lot of people, even at the talk I gave last night, said, well, you already do that when you give morphine to patients who have shortness of breath for COPD. You know, you're already shortening people's lives, so how is this any different? And that's a relentless battle we continue to face, and we spent, oh, we still do, but 2 years of advocacy trying to...
We
can hear you talking, so whoever's talking, it's Mary speaking, would you mind not talking? We can hear you. Can you please mute your phone? Sorry, Leonie, sorry.
Okay. Yep. Trying to help people understand how medications are used therapeutically. We're monitoring for side effects, and that's not part of palliative care. And the difference between palliative sedation and euthanasia has been a big thing that you'll need to think about how you approach and provide really good, clear education on that. So we can talk about that a little bit later. So I'm going to, for this presentation, I just wanted you to know we use this term MAID, which makes things seem very polite and tidy, and but I'm going to use the term euthanasia for the rest of the talk when I'm speaking about Canada, because that's the majority, vast majority of the cases that we're having. So next slide. This is information you all know well, so I'll just quickly go over it to set the stage that the percentage of the people who die from euthanasia in jurisdictions where it's legal is between about 1 and 4%. The countries that have euthanasia, it's a higher percentage, and it seems to increase more exponentially over time. So Netherlands is closer to 4%. Belgium right now is about 1.8% of all deaths that die become dead through euthanasia. And in Canada right now, we're up to 1.5%. So it's a 50% increase in the past 12 months, which is not unexpected, some people will say. But I think, you know, from our perspective, lived perspective, it's a rapid increase in the numbers. Essentially almost a doubling from where we started 2.5 years ago. As you know, the main request for euthanasia, and it's consistent in the international literature, the requests come from existential suffering and not from uncontrolled physical symptoms, including pain, but that's not what's portrayed in the media. So again, in the palliative care world, we have to do a lot of education to the broader public and the medical community to help them understand that that's actually not reality, and we need to be focusing on how we support people who have spiritual and psychological distress. And as you know, so fear of loss of control is the big one, loss of dignity, meaning, purpose, and value of one's life, fear of dying itself, and I know Catherine Maddox was here recently talking about that, how as a society we need to work on changing our culture as dying is a part of life, and people will be less afraid when they know what to expect. And fear of being a burden to others. And these are all things that make people vulnerable to wanting to hasten their death because they feel a loss of dignity and are demoralized. And so as a society, we need to think about how we're supporting that rather than necessarily the solution is euthanasia. The next slide. Just very briefly, we had things came about in Canada a little bit differently. We had this landmark Carter case where the Supreme Court of Canada basically criminalized citizens aiding and abetting someone in committing suicide, and then we were tasked Parliament to come up with a legislation within 12 months. It ended up taking 16 months. But what happened through that process is the definition of eligibility was prescribed by the Supreme Court and then written into the legislation. And that has contributed some problems with ambiguity in language, which has ultimately led to this not being tied to prognosis or a life-limiting condition, and is open to anyone with a grievous and irremediable medical condition that includes disease, disability, and illness. And it causes enduring and intolerable physical or psychological suffering that's not relieved by means accessible to the person. The person doesn't have to have had care or treatment, but they... Denise, interrupt me?
Sorry. I think we're experiencing some technical difficulties. Oh. People are hearing, when you speak, a lot of high pitch. I wonder if we move back. Let's see.
We have had some people say that their line is not very clear from their end, so if you need to hang up and dial back in.
Should we all do that? that we can stop. So let's just see.
Yeah.
Richard, could you just text us, or Peter text me? We'll see if it works. We've pushed the speaker back a wee bit.
Yeah.
Let's see if that works better. Sorry, on there.
Yeah, please let us know.
Let us know, and then we'll see how we're going. Okay, go.
So it cannot be relieved by means acceptable to the individual. Next slide. So our legislation was enacted as Bill C-14 in June 2016. It stated that both physicians and nurse practitioners could provide euthanasia. It delineated the eligibility criteria, which I'll quickly review, and a minimum standard for safeguards, which are really minimal. Like, there's three things. So a mandatory 10-day reflection period between the time you request euthanasia and the time you're provided it. Two independent witnesses to verify you're not being coerced into requesting it. And two independent assessors to say, yes, you meet the eligibility criteria. Hopefully things are sounding better. Just, is that right?
Yeah.
So keep going. Keep going. Okay. Perfect. So next slide. So the eligibility criteria is that you have, and just to say, and I'm talking a lot with my hands and you can't see me, but that the legislation in Canada is very similar to what's been proposed through your end-of-life choice bill in New Zealand. So I think the reason I'm spending so much time on this is just to really help you understand what's happened, where we started from in Canada, and how quickly it's changed over 2.5 years, and where we are today, which is not where we started from. And you would expect to experience very similar things to what we've lived through. So that's why I want to share this with you today. Are we good?
Yeah, we're good.
Oh, I think so. They can hear you speaking okay, and they can, we're just trying to sort out our, optimize the technicality. Okay, all right, back to eligibility criteria. So, have to have publicly funded, be eligible for publicly funded healthcare. Have to be currently at least 18 years of age and able to make your own healthcare decisions. As we said, you have to have a grievous and irremediable medical condition. It includes disability, chronic illness. You have to have a voluntary request and provide informed consent. And interestingly, the legislation stipulates that there's no limit to the number of times you can ask different physicians. So if you request and you're not found not to be eligible, you can just go on to find a different physician. And so there's a little bit of physician shopping that happens, and until you find some, the reality of the situation is you can just keep asking until you get it or don't get it. Next slide. So some of the problems we're dealing with because of the Carter-Cates ruling is that they didn't limit it to just the conditions in the eligibility criteria and said that this term grievous and irremediable, which is also your legislation, was really open to broad subjective interpretation, and we have now hundreds of court challenges going through the Canadian legal system to say that I have a right to it, that I have a grievous and irremediable condition that's causing me intolerable suffering. The Supreme Court and the legislation stated that physicians' conscience rights should be respected and that no one would be forced to participate. And the Supreme Court said that the rights of physicians and the rights of patients would need to be reconciled, but did not provide any structure or framework about how that would come to be, and that caused a real problem for us in Canada. And it also wasn't built into the legislation. Next slide. This part is important. I will just spend a minute on it. So in the definition of grievous and irremediable, also in your legislation, it says that natural death is reasonably foreseeable. And our court system has said that term is ambiguous and is irrelevant. I'm going to go on to the next slide. And in a landmark case in 2017, Justice Perel ruled that it was actually not necessary to determine the prognosis of a patient for their eligibility for euthanasia. And so now we have this as the new reference point to euthanasia in Canada, that you do not actually have to delineate prognosis, and it is irrelevant. And so we have had, and that led to then now lots of cases, that landmark case was a woman with osteoarthritis. And so we've had cases now that have been publicized in the media of a woman with multiple sclerosis who had an estimated, prognosis of 10 to 15 years, but that was what was written. Another case here that I referenced on the slide, patient RM, who previously denied euthanasia because she had Parkinson's disease, and her physician said, oh, well, you have at least 5 years left to live, so we can't grant you this. Since this ruling has gone through, this woman did is go on to receive euthanasia, and now this has really opened the door for mental health as the primary diagnosis, because, of course, it meets all the other criteria of grievous and irremediable conditions.
don't have to have treatment. You have to know that treatment options are there. And with the whole kind of unchanging from prognosis now, that's where we're headed in Canada. So this is Robin Moreau, next slide, a woman who had Parkinson's disease and since we're able to euthanize. And this is a quote from her from a newspaper that said, "We've changed her mind last month based on the Ontario Superior Court ruling in June that sought to ease physicians' fears that they could be prosecuted for murder if they helped a 77-year-old woman end her life when her natural death was not imminent." So what about conscience protection? So as I mentioned, we have the Supreme Court in the legislation saying we wouldn't be forced to participate if we if that goes against our moral views. But the reality is there's no system in place to protect physicians who don't want to participate. And in Canada, the healthcare is the provincial jurisdiction, and the provinces have their own colleges who are the regulatory authorities for the practice of medicine. And in some of the provinces, including Ontario, which is the largest province in Canada in terms of population and also the largest number of physicians, so I live in Ontario, and we have over 11,000 physicians who are a member of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. Our college, as well as the College of Saskatchewan, has said that it is mandatory to provide an effective referral for a patient who asks for euthanasia if you're not willing to provide it for them. And for some physicians, that is a form of participation, and they feel they're morally complicit in killing a person by providing access, by giving, you know, handing them over to a person who's going to do it and kind of finding that person. And so we're going through a lengthy court battle right now. Many physicians in Ontario have paid out of pocket to appeal this. It's gone from divisional court to superior court, and we're waiting for the ruling to come back from superior court. But next slide, in the divisional court ruling, justices on the panel said that indeed this rule that the College of Physicians and Surgeons has infringes on the charter rights of doctors to have a right to conscience, but that it was superseded by the rights of patients because we might block access to a therapeutic medical procedure. So this is how the court system worded it, and this is now the language, and again, a new standard that's been set in Canada that we're dealing with a therapeutic medical service, which has implications for where and who has to provide it, which we're going to talk about. And the panel suggested, I just throw this out there for all the physicians in the audience, as, you know, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but this is the reality of what the justices said, that those physicians who don't want to participate in euthanasia should go back and retrain for a specialty where a request for assistance to suicide can be avoided. So reality of that is, and then we had our physician group say 2.5% of all physician roles in Canada would possibly not have any interface with euthanasia, and of course we all know going back and retraining is not even a reality, nor should we have to. When we, you know, I did 17 years of university to become, you know, who I am today in a college specialist, and definitely not going to be going back and doing retraining. So the other issue that's happened is, next slide, sorry, euthanasia in Canada has really become a human right, and that's actually the way it's been worded now by the Canadian court system. So it's been deemed a therapeutic medical service, and is now also been deemed through this process of appeals we've lived through, it's a constitutionally protected civil and human right. It is paid for, publicly funded by Canadian taxpayers, and therefore must be provided in all publicly funded institutions. So what's happened, next slide, is that in Quebec, the only province so far, all sites of healthcare, including palliative care units, hospices, and all faith-based institutions, for example, the Jewish General Hospital in Montreal, which many of you may know of as Lord Balfour practice, one of the fathers of palliative care, have no ability to opt out. It has been mandated by the provincial government to regulate healthcare. Mm-hmm. You will provide it or you will lose your public funding. That's the reality in Quebec.
Yes.
In the rest of the country, it's been a constant battle to try to protect whether you're standing hospice, whether, like, I was the medical director of an intensive palliative care unit at our largest tertiary hospital in Calgary before moving to Ontario. We had to advocate and continually advocate for why we wouldn't have euthanasia in our unit, because we're trying, you know, it's so confusing between what's palliative sedation and what's euthanasia, and people are already afraid of our drugs, but to say in one room we're doing palliative sedation and we are not hasting your death, and in the next room we're giving you similar cocktail of drugs but in a lethal dose as opposed to a therapeutic, you know, monitoring meditation format, So that's one of the ways that we try to articulate how confusing that is for patients and families and other healthcare providers. They don't understand. So it's still an ongoing battle, and we get a lot of radical media stories around these terrible cases where, say, Catholic hospitals in Alberta have, you know, they're transferring people who are writhing in pain on their stretchers through ambulance, like these are the media representations, who have to be transferred to a place where they can receive, you know, this compassionate care, and we're forcing them to, we're burdening them more with suffering because we're transferring them. So these are the types of approaches that are being taken. Meanwhile, we all know we transfer people all the time for needed medical procedures. And in this case, if one could ask, is it needed? But, you know, it is deemed a therapeutic medical procedure. And we do it very safely and carefully and sedate people appropriately to be comfortable. But as we said earlier, actually, these are people who have uncontrolled physical symptoms. But that's not what the media says, right? And they, and I'm sure you all have lived examples of stories even currently in the media where things are not portrayed as they in reality they are. So, but it is something that you have to be prepared for. And the hospices have taken, and palliative care in particular, have taken a huge amount of slack and constantly being barraged with this, you must provide this, even though we know it goes against the core philosophy of palliative care. So it is something to be aware of and to think ahead proactively if this legislation goes through in New Zealand. How are you going to approach it, and how are you going to deal with the media? And you can look to certainly some institutions and hospices in Canada who have spent a long time developing guidelines and really thoughtful ways of educating people on the need and why we are going to be transferring people and how and supporting staff around that. Because the other thing that we've really dealt with, and we all know in palliative care how deeply we care for our patients and why we do this work, is there's been a real sense, in the, especially in the nursing community, around abandoning patients. So that's something we really struggled with as the palliative care community is, like, we want to protect the integrity of what we do in palliative care. And so, you know, in Calgary, I think, because I worked there for so long, the hospices wouldn't provide euthanasia on their premises. But there is this sense of those, the nurses who spend the most day-to-day time, not the nurses, but that then you're transferring these people away and you lose that relationship and you're not there for that person then at the end of their life, which you normally would be in hospice. And so there's a real different kind of ethos around how that works. And I think it's something that's really important to figure out as a profession, how we support one another in that, because it truly is a grief that we have to deal with, because that's not typically how we support a patient. So just to put that out there. Next slide. This, I think, is a really important concept. We've all heard on the slippery slope being talked a lot about in the media, and David Seymour indeed will say there is no slippery slope, and I agree with him. There is no slippery slope. It's actually a logical progression of what happens in countries that have legalized euthanasia and how we become more comfortable with things over time and consider new things that we didn't think of before because of where we were in terms of our moral stance, now become considered as we move along as the criteria expands. And so in Canada, we've looked at, have now already, as I mentioned, no association with grievous and irremediable with prognosis. So there's no requirement for that piece. And also, we have had a government-mandated task force to look at providing euthanasia in Canada for mature minors who are children. You know, there's no set minimum age, but could be 13, 14-year-olds who are considered capable of making their own healthcare decisions and could choose euthanasia for themselves. We have mental illness alone as a primary diagnosis, which I've already said is coming probably sooner than this change to the legislation because of the court ruling about prognosis being removed. And then advanced directives, as you're all very familiar with that concept. People who but you know, we're to the point in Canada now, even though the task force has reported back to the government and the legislation is yet to be amended, it's expected to happen, so much to the point that the largest academic pediatric children's hospital in Canada, Toronto Hospital for Children, has already published their guidelines for how euthanasia to these children, the mature minors, will be performed at their institution, published in the Journal of Medical Ethics. You'll see the reference there. But one of the things that's built into these guidelines is that if the child says, I don't want my family to know, the parents will be notified after the child has been euthanized. And I think that's important for you to know, because these are those logical progression of where this goes. This is already happening in children in the Netherlands.
And beyond that, then the next step is euthanasia for children, where the parents decide on behalf of a child who's not capable of making their own health care decisions,
as you know, happens in Belgium. New considerations we're dealing with as well now, currently in Canada, we're dealing with this concept of euthanasia to living organ donation. This was just brought up at a meeting in February by the Canadian Critical Care International Meeting, and policies are already being developed on this, where organ donation is the cause of death, so patients are
sorry, we could hear whoever's talking. Would you mind, please? Sorry, it's really hard for the only can you please, whoever's talking, please, mute?
So the patient's put to sleep, and then the organs are removed from a living person. So the heart is still beating. This would be graphic, but that's how it happens. Like, it's a, you know, Canada seems like a nice country. We're similar to New Zealand. We're a nice society. This is actually what we're talking about in Canada right now. And I just don't think the rest of the world knows how quickly this shifts from where we started, where we thought we had a nice fence around, you know, people with terminal conditions, and over 2.5 years where we've come to the point we're talking about euthanasia through living organ donation as a way to get more transplant viable organs. We're also talking about, and this is very important for physicians, there's a new professional association for those people who are providing euthanasia who have submitted a proposed guideline broadly to the colleges. It's not enacted, but this is where this is heading, where they say there's a duty to inform patients about euthanasia as a right, a therapeutic medical service. And so when a patient is diagnosed with a serious illness, that could be COPD, it could be, you know, human heart disease, all very serious diagnoses, they need to be informed of their right to euthanasia. So just to, if, you know, that's in the works. So we're looking, next slide. Very just briefly on how this is regulated in Canada. Really, we're just collecting basic demographic information. Yes, retrospectively, then we can go back and say kind of what the average age was and what the underlying illness is and what their postal code is. But all those things, you know, cause vulnerabilities for people to want to hasten their death and have existential suffering, including social isolation, marginalization, depression, like lack of language abilities. We know, did I say socioeconomic status? We're only collecting postal code. That is not a substitute for income and socioeconomic status. And in Oregon, which is a little bit different, because it's physician-assisted suicide only, there's no euthanasia there, we've seen a rapid increase in the percentage of patients requesting assisted suicide who are on social welfare programs. So from, I think it was 33%. Actually, here I have 44.8%, which was the the average from 1998 to 2016. Now in 2017, it's almost 68% of people who request assisted suicide, are on social welfare programs. So, you know, I think that has some implications for how we're assessing and taking care of our vulnerable populations. Next slide is on death certificates. In Canada, we're actually mandated. You cannot list euthanasia as the cause of death on death certificates. You have to say the underlying illness. You cannot mention, forbidden to mention, the drugs that we use in administering physician-assisted death euthanasia on the medical record. So again, like, how do we, going back and monitoring, how this is this being done safely? Are there wrongful deaths? Are the people who are getting euthanized actually truly meeting the criteria, and they had their vulnerabilities addressed before, you know, proceeding to this as an exceptional case? That is not the reality in Canada. Next slide. I'll just mention briefly, all the provinces kind of collecting data differently. Quebec has done a more robust job of collecting data and sharing their data publicly. And even in Quebec, where they're doing a bit of a better job, we have data gaps. I don't know what those cases, so here I've laid out in a 2-year, 3-month period from December 2015 to March 2018, almost 1,700 people died through euthanasia in Quebec. And of those, there are 142 assisted deaths that are unaccounted for. And what I mean by that is you have to report as a doctor that you provided euthanasia, fill out the, you know, required minimal paperwork, which is a series of check boxes, and then the institutions have to report to the college that they've performed so many cases of use of data. And there's a discrepancy in the Quebec data between doctors reporting and institutional reporting. And we don't know what happens to these 142 cases. Makes you wonder, were the rules followed, and why is there a gap in data? But, I mean, that's a big problem. Next slide. Really just to say on this slide about the system of oversight, there's no system a stop mechanism in terms of how do you put adequate safeguards in when wrongful death is catastrophic. Obviously, you can't go back when someone's been euthanized. We need mechanisms, and so do you, if this goes through, that if something's identified as a red flag, like this patient didn't have access to disability services or palliative care. Right now in our monitoring, it says, do they have access to palliative care? Yes, no. If you check no, no further steps happen. It's just a checkbox, and the procedure goes forward anyway. So retrospectively, we can say, oh, X number of people didn't have access to palliative care. But if it's not able to stop the process from continuing and us to address those vulnerabilities, then that's a big problem. Next slide. Quickly, just to have a look at some of our Canadian stats. Median age, based on our 2017 data, was 73, just over 50% male, about two-thirds cancer diagnosis. Neurodegenerative was next, 13%, and then a mixture of all other types of medical conditions. We're not capturing race, which I've already talked about, is a problem in ethnicity. Because it's euthanasia, it's still largely done in hospital, but there's a, you know, about 40% of cases that are done in the home, compared to, of course, you'll see there the organ information, which is assisted suicide not allowed to be done in a public place. It has to be done in your own home. I'm not sure why. What the other 12.5% are done. As I said, one out of 2,700 deaths in 2017 in Canada were through assisted suicide. And at that time, it was about 1% of all deaths. We are not checking, as you'll see here, failure to comply with the requirements of regulations. We're just simply not monitoring and checking if physicians are compliant, if those minimal safety requirements are being followed. And in Oregon in 2017, they reprimanded two physicians for failing to comply with the regulations. So other places they're trying to capture this information, we're not. Now, as I mentioned, we're increased our euthanasia rates by 50%. So in 2018, we had 4,235 deaths, which brings Canada's total to about 8,000 deaths, which accounts for about 1.5% of all deaths. And the relevance for that, I think, is that 98.5% of all people who are dying in Canada do not want to be euthanized. And when the proponents of euthanasia are speaking about, you know, the rights of these few, we need to think about the rights of the overall population. And how are we providing safeguards for those people to not be made vulnerable or to have to choose euthanasia because they don't have any other options for care? And to prevent wrongful death is important. And this is next slide, vulnerability to access to care. You all know this just as well as I do, but for the Canadian context, we have less than 15% of people in their last year of life get publicly funded home care services. Less than 30% of Canadians have access to palliative care. And there, as probably as there are here, there's long wait lists for long-term care, which is also very expensive. So this is our starting point, you know, when in a time now we have these data. And so next slide, what you see is, we'll come back to that slide, is that we're now, reality is patients are requesting euthanasia because they can't afford long-term care. It's not saying that they're getting it, but this is happening. Patients are requesting it. Or because they don't have access to palliative care to be able to stay at home in their community. And conversely, we actually have a case where the healthcare administrative team suggested to a man who has cerebral ataxia that he should get euthanasia because they couldn't pay for him to live in hospital anymore. He actually recorded that conversation and is now appealing for a right to assisted life. But this is the reality where we're in. We don't have adequate care. There are no stop mechanisms to say, wait a minute, we should actually have care for the person and see if their desire for haste and death persists. Next slide. There's also been new reports in the literature to show how much money you can save the healthcare system by enacting euthanasia. This was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal within the first year of euthanasia being legalized to show that based on a 1% death rate, now we're at 1.5%, we could save upwards of $139 million. We know that end-of-life care accounts about 20% of our national healthcare budget, and I'm assuming it's very similar in New Zealand.
And so now we're in a situation where we're talking about cost savings through euthanasia, and then you can help more people because you can donate your organs through living organ donation. That sounds, it just sounds ludicrous. I realize it sounds crazy, but this is actually the life we're living in Canada right now. And the rest of the world isn't really hearing about this. They're just hearing about this rosy system and people have these peaceful deaths. But this, the bigger reality, I think, is, I hope it's helpful for you to think about how this might look in New Zealand. I've already, the next slide is about vulnerable persons and the healthcare costs. I've already mentioned this case about the healthcare administrator suggesting to that man, and then the cases of requesting euthanasia for out of fear of inadequate care or cost of long-term care. But here is to put some faces to the stories. Here is Roger Foley, next slide, who was told he should consider MAID or pay this hefty bill that he, because he was using hospital resources, because he couldn't have adequate care provided at home. He's now the one requesting a right to assisted life, which is stalled in the court system and, you know, at some personal cost to himself, but obviously he feels very passionate about that. And then the next slide is this woman who, wants euthanasia because of the fear of, not being able to afford a good place to live in long-term care. So you can read some of the quotes I've taken from the media or stories around that. Next slide. So the minimum standards we do have in place for safeguards, I'll just briefly say this, is that 10-day waiting period and these independent assessments and capacity. So move on to the next slide. The 10-day waiting period can be waived. It's built into the legislation if two criteria are met. One is that death becomes imminent during that 10 days, and if the loss of capacity becomes imminent, so that they may not be able to consent then at the 10-day mark. And both of those two independent assessors have to agree that those two conditions are met. But the reality is most people are having this waiting period waived, and that's the next slide. We have data from Quebec. We haven't reported any of the data from the rest of Canada, so I can only speak to one province. But 60% of cases in Quebec have had the 10-day waiting period waived. Of those, 48% of them did not meet those two criminal code exemption requirements of imminent loss of capacity or imminent death. And 25% of them actually had no reason documented in the healthcare record. So we have no idea why it was waived. But there's certainly an intense pressure that I see and live on a daily basis where patients and families, they just want it now. They make a decision and they can't wait. They just need to have it. And so, and you know, anecdotally in my institution, it happens more often than not as well, and with no clear indication. But at least we have good data here from, data from Quebec. So we know there's good data to say that this is a problem. And then you all know around next slide around capacity, how difficult it is to really assess capacity. There's so many, nuances and complexities around, mild cognitive impairment. You know, lots of our patients struggle with early dementia that's not diagnosed. We all know about the, about delirium and how difficult that is. And in Canada, there's no formal training requirements for being a euthanasia provider assessor to know how to assess capacity, and no mandated requirements for psychiatric assessments in these complex cases. I've certainly been involved in cases where I have said and documented in the medical record and contacted the euthanasia team to say, as a palliative medicine expert, this patient has delirium and needs a formal capacity assessment by a psychiatrist before continuing down this path, and has been, my advice has been completely disregarded. Next slide. So what are the impacts on medicine and on palliative care? Are we doing for time? Where? Perfect. Okay, so I'm going to be finishing up for the next 5 minutes. So just quickly to go through here how it's impacted medicine. I've already said it's now deemed a therapeutic medical service, and it has become normative for the medical profession to provide it. And it is to the point where you actually have to justify the exception for not providing it. And it's really initiated a radical change in our medical culture in Canada around, and an example of this is, you know, we all work with, well, many of us work with medical students and residents and other colleagues, and now you get a mention from a patient of, you know, I'm thinking about wanting to die. You live day to day, right? It's part of coming to terms with your mortality, like a serious illness. We talk about death, our desire for early death, waxes and wanes through a course of an illness. There's really great work by Harvey Chachinov, one of our Canadian palliative psychiatrists. He's done a lot of work on dignity therapy. I'm sure you're familiar with him, who's documented how that changes over. But now in Canada, mention wanting to hasten your death, and right away you're referred to. So we've lost practically this whole sentence, and we know we work hard in high care, but we aren't seeing all these patients, right? And because we're seeing against euthanasia, sometimes we're not even involved in it. And so there'll be a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, and the medical student, the residents, they're like, oh, well, they want me. And so it's like, well, no, you need to actually sit back and say, what are they saying? And explore what, you know, we all know, as we do every day, like, what is the underlying suffering? And, you know, it's not necessarily that they want to be euthanized. And so that's one of the examples of what I mean by a radical change in culture. And I've just assumed now that you want euthanasia and you have a right to that, and we should just go down that path. So it's just this real normalization that this is another medical procedure and it's actually no big deal. That's kind of a culture that we're living in now. And indeed, so we've been struggling in Canada to have palliative care basic competencies embedded in all of the medical training programs, and it has not been implemented. In fact, our National Society is actually publishing a report about, you know, the lack of adequate training in palliative care at a med school level, never mind residency level, right? But, you know, it's been rapidly incorporated into the curriculum about how we need to teach. Again, that's another radical shift in the medical culture. In fact, the head of the associate dean for the undergrad schools in Canada, within, you know, a couple of weeks of this legislation being enacted, spoke up and said that we need a national plan for how we implement this into the curriculum, when we're still fighting 10 years later after developing palliative care competencies for all undergrad programs, getting basic training implemented for palliative care, which we know 98.5% of the people who are dying will benefit from, and they don't want to be euthanized. So, you know, it's again, it's this tiny minority of people that are asking for this, and that's having a significant impact on medicine and palliative care as a whole. Next slide. We talked a little bit about this in terms of typical violations of traditional medical ethics. So we'll just skip that and move on to palliative care for the next slide. David Seymour, some of the euthanasia lobbyists here, are certainly saying that this goes hand in hand with palliative care in Canada. It's actually in countries where it's been legalized, it has increased palliative care resources. That is just simply not true. In fact, we have not seen any net new funding for palliative care in Canada, and the funding that is in existence, so we had a large amount of money, $6 billion, dedicated to home care, including palliative home care, increased resources. We know 15% of people don't have access to home care in the last year of life. That was sent out to the provinces, but the provinces get to decide what to do with it. And in Ontario, for example, euthanasia is considered part of end-of-life care, and they've lumped it together with palliative care. And so the nurse practitioners who are providing palliative care in the community are also providing euthanasia. And so a dedicated palliative care resource with federal funding to be used for palliative home care is actually being used to provide euthanasia. And so actually we have effectively decreased resources and access to palliative care also being used for euthanasia. So in fact, I would say we have less resources. In a province like Quebec, they've actually kept track of the number of palliative care physicians. We're not doing that in the rest of Canada. And they have shown that physicians have chosen to leave palliative care, and they have decreased number of trainees entering palliative care training programs because it's in part being forced into all the areas, including contact care units and hospices. And physicians don't want to practice palliative care in that type of environment. And in fact, I have a quote here on this slide from the College of Medicine of Quebec, which is the Direct Physicians College, who published an article. This is just from CDC, but there's actually a report that went to the federal government to say that they're concerned that there's a lack of palliative care services in parts of Quebec that may be forcing patients to choose euthanasia and medical aid in dying as a way to end their lives. And that is a reality we're seeing now in Canada. And here being reported by the Physicians' College in Quebec. Next slide. I mentioned earlier that there's this increased confusion between palliative sedation and euthanasia. We live on a daily basis, increased concern from patients and families that, and more reluctance, I would say, for us to be able to use opioids and benzodiazepines to control symptoms, because that might be hastening their death than they want. Now we have a new term, it's called MAIL, medical assistance in living, where people are saying, I want medical assistance in living. But there's a real fear around us getting involved. And then there's also a fear, which we did not anticipate, this last point here, is that patients are refusing medications because they're worried we're going to cause them to lose capacity and they won't be eligible for euthanasia. That is a day-to-day trouble in hospice and palliative care units and in palliative home care.
that people are refusing their medications, and if it's not the people, the families are refusing surgeries to take their medications because it may affect their capacity. And they want to make sure they keep that door open to being able to receive euthanasia. So from my, it's very distressing as a healthcare clinician to know that we could do a better job of controlling symptoms, but not being able to be allowed to do so because of that fear. That's a real thing of what we're experiencing. So just to end off here, so we've got the time for questions. I love this quote that Harvey Toshnoff and Dr. Mal partnered on to great Canadian healthcare physicians, both of them. To be clear, healthcare is not a panacea that can eliminate every instance of suffering. However, the physician-patient relationship is complex and profound. Resisting DKD for patients at the end of life, as you all know, is compromised with a steadfast commitment to non-abandonment and a tone of care marked by respect, kindness, and an unwavering affirmation of patient worth. And I think as a society in New Zealand, you need to think about, by definition, if you have state-sanctioned euthanasia, you are saying that some lives are not worth living. And that is something that is not consistent with the values of palliative care. And I mean, it's just this, when you read this and you think, how is this the place we've come to as a society? And I'll summarize in a second, but I also want to end because I'm a little bit of a Tolkien fanatic, and I'm in New Zealand, and I'm sure you are all sick of Lord of the Rings, so I'm going to say it anyway, but to me, how we accompany people in suffering and palliative care is so nicely summed by this quote from Samwise Gamgee: "Come, Mr. Frodo, I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you." I just love it. Okay, so really, we haven't got it right, Kansas, along the short of what I'm trying to tell you, despite what we're hearing, that we've done this so well and we should copy Canada, and they're a nice bunch of people, we're like cousins in New Zealand and Canada. You can see from hopefully what I've said, the, just the data, well, lack of data, but also the information I've given you about this logical progression, this changing criteria for eligibility that will happen here if this legislation goes through. There's simply no way to put in legislation that will not prevent wrongful death. I just don't see how that can happen. And there's just no proper systems or safeguards in Canada, but also in the way it's been structured in New Zealand is very similar. And if you can't actually go back and get information on a case once it's happened, even if you were, say, the parents of a 14-year-old who was deemed to be a mature minor, you found out after that, you have no right to go back and say what happened and get the details of those cases. It's all protected. So this is something to think about. The forced participation of some publicly funded institutions, which is a continuing battle in Canada, and really, I'm not sure where it's going to go, and the forced participation of some hospices and healthcare units, and really just that impact on palliative care, the practice of palliative care. So I hope I've given some insight into this, the actual lived experience of it in Canada. So that's it. Thank you.
Leonie, thank you so much for a very provoking, thought-provoking and challenging conversation that we need to be having. So really appreciate your session and also your lived experience of what the reality is, which I think we're all struggling to come to terms with. Look, we'd apologise for the sound issues. I think we'll take questions. I'm just going to try and manage this, so bear with me. I think what we'll do is we'll just go through the country because I think that's the best way. So I'll start at the bottom of the South Island. Does anyone in South Island have any questions? Okay. Otago. Canterbury. Anyone from Canterbury like to ask a question, comment?
No, thanks, Mary. We're all sitting in stunned silence.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm heading over to Nelson in Marlborough. Anyone there?
Hi, it's Hospice Marlborough here. I think we're all saying we're in stunned silence. Very good presentation. And just to have some understanding of someone on the ground in a country where this is legal, it's been really quite... I think we're all quite challenged by this. So really good thought. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Coming up to Wellington, any comments or questions from Wellington?
Hi Mary, Teresa from Mary Potter. Could you just talk us through the timeline, please, of, you know, the next steps in terms of the legislation and what potentially what would happen afterwards, and maybe perhaps nationally, and what the various you know, professional organisations maybe thinking about doing around it all. Just that national overview, please. Thank you.
Okay, certainly, Teresa. Hi. So what's happening currently is that we're waiting for the report. Now, Sinead's here, and Sinead might want to chip in.
So
Sinead, we're waiting for the Justice Select Committee's report, which we are expecting
next Wednesday.
And then after that, it will go for a second reading.
Yeah, and potentially that can be on May the 1st, and the vote potentially could be May the 1st.
And that's for a second reading?
Yeah, and then it goes to the Committee of the House.
Yeah.
Generally, no bill that gets that far is rejected.
So if Rachel here, so after the second reading, there'll be the conference vote, and depending on how that goes, it will, if it's a yes, it will pass into law, and then the next stage is the whole of House, which is where slight amendments to the legislation can be made. So that next point at some time in May is going to be the real critical point for us to understand whether we're going for the yes or the no situation.
And yeah, just to remind, I mean, there were 76 MPs who voted for it and 44 against at the first reading. So for those of us who are trying to prevent this legislation, we're trying to change that. But that's quite a big number of MPs who have voted for it. And we believe that the greatest impact will be we, the people, speaking to our MPs, tell them our opinions.
And so just nationally, Teresa, AMSAM, Hospice New Zealand, Palliative Care Nurses NZ and Hospital Palliative Care have had, are working together, and we, Hospice New Zealand has written to all MPs, and we are having some meetings with MPs. We've offered to meet, and we are having some meetings, quite a number, in fact. So locally, hospices are making their own approaches and decisions, but nationally, that's what we are doing. We're quite actively wanting to engage with members of Parliament.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Teresa. Anyone from Lower Heart, any comments or questions from Te Aumanga? Keep moving. Arahanui, Palmerston North. Wairapa. Taranaki. Hawke's Bay. How am I doing here? Central of the country. Anyone from the centre of the country?
Hawke's Bay.
Yes,
hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for a really interesting talk, Leonie. I guess I'm interested to hear about the Canadian experience with regards to law change and the campaign against that. What do you think was the main sort of failings or things that could have been done better to have prevented the situation?
Well, so I don't think in Canada we have that opportunity because we did it so strangely where it was decriminalized by the Supreme Court and then we were mandated to come up with legislation. So you have a different opportunity than we did. So all we could do is try to inform the committee who were building the legislation, you know, to try to put the – back then we thought the tallest fences around this that we could. Now having our lived experience, that's actually not possible. It will change over time, and this is what will happen in any country who legalizes. Once the door opens, it's like it's wide open, or I think the other analogy I've been using is the – once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back in. Very quickly, this becomes a medical procedure that people have a right to and a human right, right? And so now you have these landmark cases that are, although they're Canadian cases, they are looked at around the world as reference points. And New Zealand will look to Canadian case law as well as a standard when they're developing their own thing. So I think, you know, if we had a chance to do it differently like you're doing it, it would be really getting to those MPs And because they're the ones who get to vote on this, supposedly on your behalf, so you need to make sure they understand the core issues and how this impacts the 98.5%, 100% of patients, not just, you know, these 1.5% of patients, and the reality of how that impacts medicine and palliative care in particular. So please advocate and have your voices heard. That's the best thing you can do.
Thank you, Leonie.
Thank you.
Anyone else from Lakes, Bay of Plenty, Waikato?
Hi, Mary. It's Richard here. Just wanted to ask, and thank you, Leonie, for a fantastic talk and very terrifying talk in a way. Would you say that this is the beginning of the end for palliative care in Canada?
Well, we would like not to think that's the case. And, you know, I am been involved in the specialty society for many years, and we're working really hard to keep palliative care and advocate. And I didn't get to tell, I've told a lot of doom and gloom today because it is truly terrifying. But we've also been championing a new national palliative care framework. But again, it's this constant battle to say why euthanasia is not part of that. And there's a real push around the world, actually, by minority of people who think that this is really the ultimate end to good palliative care. So I don't think it's the end of palliative care, because I don't think we can let it be the end of palliative care. But I won't lie and say that it's not a very difficult battle. And it's a very fine line to walk to be respectful, you know, of a patient and a legal right that people have. And really, the way we've approached it as a specialty society is to say that these people need palliative care, too, all the way to the end of their life. And we want to provide palliative care, because the way we're being perceived is that we're against it, and because we said it's not part of palliative care, which is not what we've said. We said people need palliative care, and we continue to advocate for most people need palliative care, and the 98% don't want to be euthanized. So I think that would be something for you to think about, is if this bill goes through, how do you approach it to say, like, we care for people no matter what? I mean, maybe I don't know what you're going to say, but the way, you know, you might think about it would be, we provide palliative care, and that is, we've been able to make it distinct at the level of the Canadian Medical Association. So we've got a general council motion through that said palliative care is distinct from medical assistance in dying. But it's still this selfless battle, despite that, to say this is what we do in palliative care, and you're just going to have to keep at it, and we want to provide palliative care to those patients, too, no matter what their end-of-life choice is. And they need palliative care, and whether or not they allow that type of care to be provided is a separate issue. But it is a very challenging environment to work in, and I encourage you to do that as well, because it's not going to be the end of palliative care if I have anything to do with it. And so many of us feel the same way, because these patients also need palliative care. So.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Richard. Tairāwhiti, and Waikato, South Auckland.
Yeah, hi, Stuart Bell here from Hamilton, Waikato Hospice. Thanks very much for a great talk. I wonder if somebody could just send through the links to the various papers and other material you mentioned earlier. That would be good. My question is really, I used to work in British Columbia until about 4 years ago in palliative care. I know many of my colleagues there have either resigned or pulled back from leadership positions or gone on stress leave. And I wonder if you're seeing that across the country, the people who are opposed to palliative care being put in that situation.
Opposed to euthanasia, right?
Yeah.
Opposed to euthanasia in the last 2.5 years.
Yes, definitely. And I referenced data from Quebec to that effect as well, that there's fewer physicians practicing palliative care and fewer trainees entering the specialty. I can't speak to actual numbers across the rest of Canada because they're simply not being shared. I think from a specialty society perspective, you know, we've continued to engage the membership on this issue both pre and post legislation, and our members have, their views have actually not changed despite what the media is saying. And our latest poll says that 92% of our physician membership in palliative care physician society does not provide euthanasia. There are a few vocal physicians who seem to think they speaking on behalf of the other 92%, including the president-elect of our Canadian Medical Association, who calls himself a palliative care physician and provides euthanasia. But those are very much the minority. And the way that we've been approaching it as a specialty society is that if you choose to do euthanasia, you can choose to practice any other areas of medicine. You do it outside of the role of palliative care. That it's not one and the same because it's distinct. And so you recognize that maybe a few individuals who choose to do that, and they do that, but they don't do it with their palliative hat on. And the other thing we've done at the Canadian Medical Association level is we passed the General Council motion to say they're distinct. We also passed a motion very early on, the 6 months of the legislation, to say that a palliative care consultation is not the same as an assessment for medical aid in dying. And so that's another thing, like, you have to be very proactive around these things because there's this intense pressure that you do end of life care, so this is going to be what you do. And that was how we've been very, like, rigorously, like, so this, we have to think ahead to some of these things about how to protect the type of work that we do in palliative care but still and benefit the most people.
Great, thank you. Any other comments or questions from Auckland?
No, but you've got one from Taranaki, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Sorry, we cut ourselves off by accident. My name's Catherine Page. I'm a doctor at Hospice Taranaki, and you might have been asked this question when we were cut off and out of the loop. I wondered if what impact, Leonie, it's had on mental health provision in Canada, because now you've got the bizarre situation in the law where people can be, suicidal people can be under the Mental Health Act to prevent them committing suicide because they're mentally ill, but then they can say they have a prolonged enduring illness that's intolerable and can now ask for the right to euthanasia. Has that been an issue?
Yeah, so there was an issue in the very beginning of the legislation, and what I mean by issue is patients, and again, we have Quebec data, but not, I'm sure it happened in other places in Canada. I'm giving you the data that I have. Patients who had attempted suicide and were not successful were brought into the emergency room and were not resuscitated when they could have been because the doctors were confused what was euthanasia and how they were supposed to respond to these suicide attempts. And the Quebec Medical College had to actually speak to that and say, yes, you are very confused. And now they're trying to just, and then subsequently they tried to separate it out. But we're entering back into the confusing arena again, because really it is expected that the legislation will actually be amended to formally include mental health. But even now, as you said, the court has already set the stage for that to come. So we're just starting to get into the arena now where we're starting to really get into the meat of that, and the psychiatric community is specialist groups are starting to speak to that. So it's going to be very difficult. I don't have more information at this point to give you on that, but that's a new arena, a review of that arena, because at first we got it totally wrong and we're like, well, they want to die, so we should let them die. So that was what happened, and where we're going, I'm not quite sure. But, I know the Indigenous communities in Canada, similarly to here, have very high suicide rates, especially in their youth. And so that's going to be a very challenging area to figure out. Like, you may have someone coming in, committing suicide, and then are saved. And then what if then a week later or 2 weeks later they say, well, I'm going to have euthanasia. Like, it's very difficult.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
No answers, I'm sorry. More questions than answers.
Okay, so any other comments or questions for Leonie?
Yep, question. This is Nina Braham, another one of the doctors here at Hospice Taranaki. Excellent presentation. Thank you very much. I wanted to find out what the general population's reaction to the law that to euthanasia, do they see the problems that have occurred in the past few years, or are they happy?
So very good question. Two things to say to that is the general public still does not understand what this is all about. People ask for MAID, and really they're asking for palliative care. It's a big problem. They really don't understand the difference. And when you explain to them how it is you can support them through palliative care, they're like, oh, yes, that's what I want. And so the real fear that I have, and I know many palliative care physicians, is we don't get to see all these patients because there's this knee-jerk reaction that, oh, well, they want MAID, and then the MAID team gets involved, and then, you know, they're not palliative care clinicians who are part of the MAID by and large. It's mostly not. And so we don't know what they're telling them about palliative care and what their options are and how they could be cared for. And so I really worry that people, and I mean, it's happening in Quebec, that are choosing euthanasia because they don't have access to palliative care, but they don't actually even understand the difference. And then there's a lot of people who are saying, well, including a guy at a debate yesterday, one of the cardiologists, a thing I participated in 2 days ago, who said, well, you know, withdrawing life-sustaining therapy like dialysis, all those things is the same thing, which is ludicrous, but the general public doesn't understand those nuances, and so really needs to be like a concerted public education campaign around, as well around normalizing and talking about what dying looks like, but around and just like, I think that would be something that's really important as a society to be focusing on is education. And I knew I had some other point that I wanted to say in reference to your question, and I've forgotten what it was. Public. Yeah, so they're not informed.
It's really
normal.
It's all normalized.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's lost the
point. Okay. But it comes back. Sorry. Right. Listen, is there anyone else? We're welcome. One or two more comments or questions.
There's one more comment from Waikato.
Right.
I'm Tom Reed, one of the physicians here. Thank you so much for a very sobering talk. We just wanted to mention that our interactions with our local MPs, which we've undertaken, would suggest that in many ways this could be a fait accompli, in which case they were saying our only hope might be to add in some protections, particularly for our hospice and around the country, at the level of the amendments. And I just wondered if anyone had been thinking about what plan B would be if the vote does pass.
This requires so much energy, and we're very focused on preventing it becoming legal. So maybe Waikato, the MPs, we don't think it's a fait accompli. There's great opportunities to make a difference. It's the people who need to speak. And clearly you have spoken to your MPs, but there's the rest of the country as well. So, for us who are fighting this, with you, the important thing is to say we can win this. It's a different situation to Canada. It came through the court system. This is through the MP system, through a democracy. So we think we can win it. It just requires us to be courageous and just keep talking to our MPs, turning up the electorate, emailing them, telling them that you're not going to vote for them if they vote for this, that it's going to have electoral consequences. And then, so we need to turn up at their door, turn up in emails, we can win this, and we've got the time, we've got great people around who are engaged and active, and so this is a great opportunity for us to stand up, we can win this.
I mean, I'm an outsider, but I've been meeting with MPs, I'm meeting with more MPs while I'm here, and I'm getting a sense that some people voted it through because they wanted to hear more about it. It wasn't a fait accompli that they had made up their minds. They just thought, well, maybe it's time to hear a bit more about it. So let them hear more about it. And I believe from some of the interactions I've had that these people could be swayed and they should be listening to their constituents. So you've got to be equally strong in your advocacy as pro-euthanasia groups are.
Thank you very much. I think
Just to comment that the media up to Monday were kind of implying, as Rachel would know, that kind of it was a walkover, that there was only David Seymour, who featured quite a bit in the media. And now the language on the television and the radio on Monday was, this is going to be a fight. Yeah, now we're equal already within days by just standing up.
Thanks, Sinead.
Hi, Nopez and Hospice. We're just wondering, are we able to share this PowerPoint?
Yes, you may, of course, yes, no problem with that.
Right. Okay, look, I think, anyone has any burning comments or questions?
Go ahead. Kathy Lynch from Mercy in Auckland. Just wondering, could you comment on any impact it's made on aged residential care and vulnerable seniors in Canada, please?
Oh, I mean, that's a huge issue for us. And I certainly mentioned some of the cases where people are asking for euthanasia because they feel they have a lack of access to good quality aged residential care or that it's too expensive for them. So we're certainly seeing that as a vulnerability, and it's going to become a bigger issue once the advanced directives go through. That's a more vulnerability because other people then will decide when to enact something that someone's asked about in advance. So I think it's definitely becoming a bigger issue in Canada as we march through this logical progression.
I would just like to say thank you for the opportunity. I know many of you are probably gobsmacked, and some days I think to myself, like, is this real? Like, you know, it sounds like so crazy, the stuff that I've told you today, but it is real. It's very real. This is what we're dealing with every day in Canada, and it's pretty heartbreaking. I won't lie. That's why I'm here. Thank you. But if you think of questions, I'm happy to be you to share my email, because I know it's we're all crying. I know that it's hard, like, when you're getting, like, information that's kind of shocking, to kind of necessarily at this time think about the things that you may want to ask about. So I'm happy to be and be a resource for and to connect with other people in Canada that might be, like, hospices and people that have walked the walk, depending where things go, to be a resource to support one another.
Yeah. Well, Leonie, thank you so very much. We really do appreciate your experience and the incredible impact it's having on you and your colleagues in Canada. So we're very grateful. And thank you all very much for your participation, and keep on fighting the good fight. Okay. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.